The death car, said the post, sped out of the night, clocking no less than 50, and, while trying to pass a slow-moving truck in the borough of Queens, found itself facing a car coming from the other direction. To avoid a head-on collision, it cut in front of the truck so sharply that the car lost control, carried wide onto the shoulder, and struck a woman hitchhiker. What actually happened was different. A woman suddenly dashed into the road, wildly waving her arms as if she knew who we were and wished us to stop. She left Lily no time to brake. Forced with only two choices, swerve left toward an oncoming car or right into a ditch, Lily chose the former. But the speed of the oncoming car made it impossible for us to get past the woman and return to our own lane in time. Realizing her error, Lily wheeled back into her lane, hitting the woman dead on. Terrified, Lily floored it and raced through the darkness, but almost immediately Rodman ordered her to pull the car off the road and allow him to drive. Then Lily fell into his lap, hysterical. As Rodman consoled her, I scrambled out and ran to see the state of the woman. It took me several minutes to reach the garage where they'd taken the body. The station, with its two gasoline pumps, advertised cheap service. At the end of the garage stood a circle of people. Peering round the onlookers, I saw that the woman had been wrapped in a gray barracks blanket and placed on a workbench. A large man, bending over her and crying, was keeping everybody else at bay. I got a close look. What I saw made me swallow the two sticks of gum I'd shoved into my mouth upon hearing the sickening sound of the impact. Lying there on the table was Gertie Densmore, and standing next to her was a steely-eyed Brad Gillespie. All you could see was her head and one arm resting outside the blanket with her fist clenched. Brad leaned over the body as if to pray or kiss the woman's forehead, but he did neither. From my crouching position, I could see him force her fingers apart. In her hand rested a thin necklace chain, attached by means of a prong setting to a diamond. The missing Farouk. Brazenly, he snatched the jewelry, pocketed it, and shoved his way through the crowd. No one said a word, perhaps because his body had blocked their view. When I asked myself how Pop would have reacted, I realized that my father could no longer help me. This was grave territory we had never discussed. I was without a guide, alone. For the first time in my life, I understood why people seek solace from rabbis and priests. If one had come by, I would have begged for advice. Retreating to the rear of the crowd, I heard heart-rending groans coming from the office attached to the garage. Two men were huddled together, the one repeating Gertie's name and holding his gut as if any minute he'd vomit, I figured was Mr. Densmore. A motorcycle policeman with siren blaring pulled up and immediately started interviewing the witnesses, each of whom contradicted the last. Brad, wishing to leave, dismissed any doubts the policeman might have entertained about him by explaining that the woman had died before he arrived, and so moved was he by the accident that he had cried. Just ask the others. How do you know her? Queried the cop. I buy my gas from her husband, Brad answered tersely, pointing to the office. Just ask George. Why the cop wasn't suspicious beats me. Normally, customers don't cry over their grease monkey's wife, but the policeman quickly lost interest in Brad. A minute later, the cop was lost in his notes, taking down names and erasing them when the person corrected his spelling. Brad said a few words to Mr. Densmore and left without having noticed me. The policeman, trying to sort out the facts, excused himself, explaining that he had yet to interview Mr. Densmore. Gertie's husband, sitting in a reclining desk chair, rocked back and forth, periodically wailing and pointing toward the garage. I easily overheard him and the cop because the door connecting the garage to the office was missing. Apparently, Gertie and her husband lived in this dump in an upstairs apartment over the garage. Mr. Densmore complained that she often took trips to the city and came home with purchases that exceeded her allowance. Where had they come from? The dresses and shoes and perfumes and jewelry. He also had his doubts about the weekends that she claimed to be spending with her sister in Manhattan. Why, he asked, did she often come home with a tan and her clothes smelling of salt water? And who had given her a costly diamond which he'd seen among her possessions? He staggered toward the body, saw that the jewel was missing, and howled like a wounded beast. Returning to his office, he blew his nose with a grease rag. When he started talking again, it was to no one in particular. I know she wanted better, she and her sister. They left school before they was teens and worked in shirt factories and dime stores and hash houses. She didn't want no kids. Her girlfriends, she was always reminding me, scrubbed endless diapers on galvanized washboards. I don't want to be trapped like that, she would say. I want to see the world. I want a different kind of life. Thing is, with that diamond, we could have lived good. A doctor pulled up, bustled in with a black bag, and withdrew a stethoscope. Listening for a heartbeat and finding none, he came to the profound conclusion that Gertie Densmore was dead. For the first time, I saw the extent of her injuries, as the physician, who introduced himself as Dr. Littlewick, removed the blanket to a collective gasp of horror. Gertie Densmore had practically been cut in half. One breast hung from a flap of skin, and her intestines, looking like a string of red sausages, were seeping out of her belly. I gagged, turned away, ran to the front of the garage, and puked. When the doctor had finished his examination and conferred with the cop, I politely asked him which direction he was going. Northport, he replied. Why? I need a ride home. My boyfriend and I had an argument. He drove off and left me. Aren't you a little young to be dating? I could see I had a blue nose on my hands. You're quite right, sir, I answered, and I've sure learned my lesson. No more boys and late nights for me. Clever child, the doctor patronizingly said, and told me to hop in, offering to drop me off at Rodman's estate, which belonged, I explained, to my uncle. You mean that big place the Prohibition agents recently raided? I wouldn't know about that. I just returned from London. A favorite city of mine, he exclaimed as we started down the road. What did you see? I could have pinched myself. Every time I phony up, I land in the soup. You know, the usual. The doctor was driving a black Cadillac with leather seats, so I figured that he, like most Americans, had a sweet spot for cars. Some automobile. Glad you like it. My wife wanted something less...
showy?
Her very word.
Women don't mind being showy themselves, but when it comes to a car, they think you have to be conservative to be classy.
Dr. Littlewick was obviously pleased that I'd taken his side. Once I praised his choice in autos, he grew talky, jabbering nonstop about what he called his philosophy of life. Hearing it, I decided I might have been better off walking. According to him, what mattered most in this world was order. People left to themselves, he earnestly said, make foolish decisions. For their own well-being, they must be controlled. Mind you, I wish it weren't so, but for their own good, they need rules.
He said that in his own family, his two sons wouldn't breathe without first asking him. As for his daughter, she always deferred to the men, as a young woman should.
Dr. Littlewick reminded me of the teachers I loathed. His house sounded like a prison.
As he gabbed, I realized here was the key to Brad Gillespie. He used money in his imposing physical presence to get what he wanted. Lily was merely a lovely purchase who dolled up his house and occasionally tempered his lusts. But when it came to the choices that mattered, whom they would have as their friends, where they could live, how much money Lily could spend, by God, he would decide.
Dr. Littlewick and Brad certainly had one thing in common. Like all unimaginative men, they loved rules. Rodman was just the opposite. He believed in spontaneity. I suddenly felt awfully sorry for Lily and for all those in the doctor's employ who had to kiss his behind for a buck. When Dr. Littlewick finally dropped me at Rodman's estate, I thanked him for the ride, letting out a sigh of relief as he drove off.
Rodman had arrived minutes before and called a cab to take them to Lily's place.
"How did you get here?" I asked.
"We took all the back roads through the farming country. I think we got away clean, but then one never knows."
"Where's the car?"
"Locked in the garage." I knew the taxi would take at least 15 minutes to reach the estate, so I asked for the key and wandered out to see the extent of the damage to Hank's yellow car. He'd thrown a tarpaulin over it, but neglected to clean the blood off the dented front end. I filled a bucket with water and washed the chrome in the grill and the crumpled right fender. Returning to the house, I told Hank that he ought to have one of his hired help replace the damaged parts and repaint the car. "Just as long as they can't trace it to Lily, I'm in no rush."
"But you may be in danger."
"Thanks for caring, Hanny, but I've been in worse jams." We went outside to wait for the cab. In the moonlight, I could see the heat shimmering over the road. The weather that day had been unrelenting, easily the hottest of the year. Lily buried her face in Hank's chest as he cradled her in his arms. I told him that I'd stay behind and arrange for his car to be stripped, repainted, and taken upstate. Lily couldn't stop crying and kept repeating, "What have I done?" She needed Rodman now. Trembling, she sobbed, "If only we could have left 5 minutes earlier or later, this might never have happened." "Just be glad the yegg-stripped car is all hours of the night," I said, trying to make Hank think about unloading his rolls. "Thanks, Hanny. You're a real friend. But if the police show up, you might be arrested." Insisting that I go with them, he refused to take no for an answer, pointing out that my previous run-in with the cops would weaken my case. Lily nodded in agreement. I should have felt pleased that she cared, but sensed she was fearful I might turn her in. I couldn't help wondering whether she'd recognized in the headlights the woman she'd seen with Brad in Cape May and deliberately hid her. Rodman, rocking her in his arms, tried to dispel the dark night of her terror. He told her it wasn't her fault. The woman had bolted in front of the car. Lily had tried to avoid her but would have killed four people in a head-on collision had she not swerved. There was nothing she could have done differently and nothing to be done now except leave matters to him. He would find out who the person was and the extent of her injuries. Whatever the cost, he would pay. If someone had identified his yellow Rolls-Royce, he would, of course, take the blame. The moment he said he'd be the fall guy, I wondered whether Lily would simply stand by and not say a word. A few hours before, I would have said impossible, but with the collapse of her world, I was no longer sure. While Rodman told her that he would keep her from harm, I spotted a book that Papa told me to read, Leaves of Grass. Without asking permission, I took it. A horn honked. I could see the lights of the cab. Lily, still resting in Rodman's arms, turned to him and said, "Tell me what happened didn't happen. Tell me I only imagined it." She kissed him. I could see tears in Rodman's eyes. As they separated, Hank brushed her hair with his lips. I climbed in and buried myself in a corner. Rodman and Lily sat without touching. Hank gave the driver directions. "You folks live in that house?" the cabbie asked, obviously impressed by its splendor. "Uh-huh," Rodman said. "Don't often get called way out here. Most folks have their own cars." "Mine's in the shop." "Which one you use?" "A place in the Bronx." "There's some top-notch garages nearby." "Thanks. I'll keep that in mind." The cabbie, receiving no encouragement, clammed up. Speaking in whispers, Hank warily asked Lily if they couldn't agree to meet somewhere in town. She shook her head no. "For now, I think you'd be better off hiding." Lily's suggestion seemed odd, but I soon understood why she said it. As the cab pulled up to the Gillespies' house, Hank reassured her, "I don't want you to worry. It's all right. I'll take the blame." She tried to smile, but the effort defeated her. "I may never see you again," he said with difficulty. "This may be the last time. But if you ever need me, all it will take is one word. Yes. All you have to say is, yes, you want me, and I will come, because I shall never cease loving you. I stayed behind as they walked to the house. When Rodman returned, he tried to persuade me to leave with the cabbie.
What about you?
I'm standing watch, just in case. Lily and I agreed on a signal. She'll raise the shade in her bedroom if there's any problem. He's in the house now.
You'll want someone to talk to.
I really think you should go to my place and rest, Henny.
I'd rather keep you company.
Rodman didn't argue. He paid the cabbie, who heartily thanked him for the generous tip. I'll bet to this day that guy still talks about Rodman, especially in light of what happened. But that's shooting ahead. Entering the house, Lily had gone directly to her room and pulled down the shade. A few minutes later, the lights came on in the kitchen. Rodman stole up to the house for a squint. I remained in the bushes. When he returned, I asked him what he'd seen.
It's all right, he said. She and Brad are just talking.
Do you suppose she's telling him what happened?
Hard to say.
Although the kitchen light remained on for almost an hour, Hank never took another look. But after a while, I couldn't resist, so I grabbed a peek. What I saw made me blink. Lily and Brad, seated at a table with a plate of cold chicken between them, were acting not like antagonists, but like plotters. Brad would say something, and Lily would nod in agreement. No one was eating. Then Brad removed something from his pants pocket. As if inviting bids at an auction, he held up the Farouk diamond. When he plopped it into her palm, Lily grinned like the Cheshire Cat. In the morning, the second and last time I looked, there was no sign of Lily or Brad, and the food was untouched, making me wonder if it was chicken or a symbol for Hank. Dead duck.